Good morning. It's good to see everybody here today. We need to get something straight right out of the gate here. Yes, there are ducks all over my tie this morning. That's what that is. As Donna mentioned, I want you all to mention to me as I walked in, I want you all to know that regardless of what you hear from me today, I do have all my ducks in a row. So that's the only joke you're getting from me today. I hope you enjoyed it. It is good to see each of you here today. I do want to encourage you to come back tonight. I hope you're planning to do that. Davis Hammett's going to be working with us to look at how we worship and how we sing and the blessing it is to be able to do that together. So plan to come back for that. And one other quick thing, if you are a recent high school graduate in college or in that kind of weird age range right after college age, if you're looking for something to do after service worship this morning, we're having a breakfast in the reception room. There's some exciting things going on with that age group. So if you're in it or you know somebody that's in it, be sure and make sure that either you plan to join us or that they plan to join us so that we can enjoy that ministry together. As Joe was mentioning how hot it is outside, I thought, well, I should see how my friends in northern Indiana are doing with this heat, and they're doing okay. It was a balmy 60 degrees there this morning, so keep them in prayer. I think they're probably suffering a little bit up there. Yesterday was an important day for me this year. It's one of the most important days of the year in my house, and that is that it was the kickoff of college football season. Now, fortunately, my team is still undefeated. Of course, they didn't play yesterday, and so we can celebrate that. But for many that do enjoy college football, there's so many that are going into it this year expecting to win some championships. They have the best quarterback coming back, the best coach coming back, the best defense coming back. There's about 6, 7, 8 teams, and their fan bases or more that all believe they're going to go out and win it all this year. In about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, all their dreams are going to be shattered. Everything that they looked forward to is suddenly going to go away. The moment that they thought was finally theirs to win the crown will cease to be. Someone said, not even God himself can sink this ship. It's a quote that was made popular by the blockbuster hit that was the movie Titanic. And while there's no factual evidence that anyone ever said this, there's plenty of historical documentation that would say that this was a common belief held by many engineers and builders at that time. It was true that the Titanic was really thought to be unsinkable. In the months leading up to its launching, a man by the name of William Pirie, who was a shipbuilder and the man responsible for overseeing the design of the Olympic-class cruise ships to which the Titanic belonged, he was asked about the lack of lifeboats on these ships. And he responded that these ships, they were unsinkable, and the lifeboats were in case somebody else needed help. Mr. Pirie wasn't on the Titanic on April 2nd, 1912. So I could imagine the feeling he got in his stomach, or I probably can't imagine the feeling he got in his stomach when he heard that this great ship, not only did it sink, but over 1,500 people lost their lives. Have you ever failed in the midst of what you expected to be one of your more proud moments in life? I've failed at a lot of things. I've not succeeded in many athletic events. I've never won any prizes for arts and crafts. I've failed my share of tests as well, despite what I'd like for my children to believe. But in almost all those moments, I really didn't expect to just succeed in some outstanding way. There was never a race when I ran in high school that I actually expected to come in first in. Whether it was a project for school or for work or a moment with my wife or my kids or something else that I felt confident about succeeding in, there is great pain that comes in the pit of my stomach when I do fail at those things, when I do when I don't succeed in those things. Last week, we looked a little bit at Peter's relationship with Jesus. And we're going to continue that conversation for a minute today. Of course, when we look at Peter's relationship with Jesus, we know that it began when Jesus arrived at a fishing dock early in the morning. He asked a couple of young men who were washing their nets after coming back empty-handed from a long night. He has them put their boat back out. He preaches, and he tells them to put the nets down, and they did, and they brought in a haul of fish. They're told it was like nothing they hadn't seen before. And so they come back, and Jesus says to Peter and his brother, "Follow me." They walked with Jesus from village to village, from house to house, and they watched and they listened as he presented himself to others. They witnessed as he healed and forgave the untouchables in their community. They observed as Jesus dealt with the doubters, such as the Pharisees and the scribes. They stood by his side as he heard of the death of his cousin John, and they watched instead of mourning as he taught and he fed thousands of people. Then, as we discussed last Sunday, Jesus sends his apostles back out on a boat, and he says he's going to meet them on the other side of the sea. He retreats to the mountain to pray and to probably mourn, and a storm rises on the sea. The apostles are afraid. Jesus walks to them on the water. Unable to see their Savior in their midst, they continue to fear, saying it's a ghost. And Jesus says, "Don't fear, it's me." And Peter says, "If it is you, tell me to walk on the water." Jesus says, "Come to me." And Peter walks on the water toward Jesus. And if I'm Peter, in that moment, I can finally say to myself, "I've made it." It's said that from a time a baseball player, a prospect is drafted, it could take him 4 to 6 years or even longer to make it into the major leagues. Can you imagine walking up to the plate or out onto the field for the first time, having reached the highest level of your sport, and you can finally say, "I've made it"? Peter steps out of the boat onto this rough sea in the face of the fierce wind, and he does it. He takes a step. Maybe he takes a couple. And again, if I'm Peter, I'm thinking, "I have made it. I'm a disciple. I've got to be one of his favorites. Look at me. I'm walking on the water. What else could be greater?" But in a moment where there should have been great, or where there could have been great, overwhelming feelings of success, he notices the storm once again. He sees the waves, he feels the wind, and he sinks. The situation quit from what could have been a crowning moment of his faith to a catastrophic one. If you fast forward a bit, Jesus would ask Peter in Matthew 16, "Who do you say that I am?" And of course, Peter responds. He says, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus goes on to say, "And I tell you, Peter, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." And again, if I'm Peter, I'm thinking, "I've made it. I'm finally here. Did you hear that, guys? He said that something I said is what his church is going to be built on. Look at me." Just a few verses after this, it says that from that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And it says that Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You're a hindrance to me. You're not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." Quickly, from a moment of pride, when Jesus says, "You are Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church," not long after that, it becomes from a moment of pride to a moment of public shame almost. "Jesus, you just called me what? Call me Satan." Peter continues to follow Jesus. He would witness this transfiguration, this glorious moment, which a booming voice and a bright cloud identifies Jesus as the Son. The days and the months and the ministry of Jesus, they go on. Peter, along with the rest of the disciples, again, would witness him teaching and correcting and loving. But the time of his death, the time of Jesus' death draws near. This is obvious in the things that Jesus says concerning judgment and the end of days and the responsibility of the disciples to follow. They all head towards Jerusalem. It's the feast of the Passover. And we need to remember something here. The Passover, of course, it was an incredibly important moment to these people, to these men. It wasn't just some sort of festival or holiday that they could choose to participate in or not if they wanted. It was a holiday that would help all the businesses and people in the community to also be successful. Hopefully you remember the story of the Israelites being brought out of slavery and bondage in Egypt. A story that, of course, includes the 10 plagues, with the 10th plague brought upon the Egyptians being the death of the firstborn. The Israelites were instructed to mark their doorposts, their homes, with the blood of a slaughtered lamb. Upon seeing this, the Spirit of the Lord would pass over, hence the name or the name that we use to refer to the holiday. Now, if a person has cancer and they beat it, they probably remember the day they were cancer-free. If a person faces all sorts of obstacles in their path, but they overcome them and become successful, they remember the day it happens. We celebrate the anniversary of major wins, of major victories. We celebrate birthdays and wedding anniversaries. And in those moments, we're not just celebrating the fact that they happened. We're not just celebrating the occasion. We're rejoicing and remembering that we overcame the obstacles. Similarly, a Passover was more than just a memory of the moment. In Exodus 12, after God gives his instructions concerning what the Israelites needed to do in order for him to pass over their homes and not bring the final plague upon them, he says of remembering that day for years to come in Exodus 12, verse 14, says, "This day shall be for you a memorial day. You'll keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations as a statute forever." Observing and celebrating this occasion, it was not an option for the people of Israel. It was a command, and a command that was to be taken very seriously. This incredibly significant setting, this is Moses describes in Leviticus, this holy convocation. It's the setting that Jesus and his apostles gather in Matthew 26, where we'll spend most of the rest of our time now. It's a holy moment. It's a special moment. Matthew 26, beginning in verse 17, it says, "Now on the first day of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying, 'Where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover?' He said, 'Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, the teacher says, my time is at hand. I'll keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.' And the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover." I don't even know how we can fully grasp the importance, the significance of this moment. We can do our best in thinking about sharing a special meal with a decorated table and a large menu. On my 16th birthday, it was tradition in my mom's family that was a significant moment, and all the aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents came, and there was a party together, just family. And for me, as I look back on my memory, it was a significant one because that was the last time my whole family was together in that way. My grandfather, the patriarch of that family, would pass away only a month or 2 months after that. All of them gathered in a room. I got to pick the menu. I got to open the presents. It was as special of a meal as I can remember, but it wouldn't even begin to measure up to the significance of having the Passover, let alone having it with the Messiah, with the chosen one, with the Lamb of God. There wasn't a moment like it before. There hasn't been a moment like it since. The closest thing we have is perhaps when we gather together for communion, and we should treat it as such. But this is the setting. This, of course, is the setting that Jesus would institute the Lord's Supper. But at this banquet, in this moment, was Jesus and 12 men, was the Messiah and 12 men, and among them the sometimes celebrated but often criticized and complex and confused Peter. In verse 30, it goes on to say that when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. And Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away because of me this night, for it's written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I'm raised up, I will go before you to Galilee.' And Peter answered him, 'Though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away.' Jesus said to him, 'Truly I say to you, this very night, before the rooster crows, you'll deny me 3 times. And Peter said to him, 'Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you.' And all the disciples said the same. Verse 33 again, he said, though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away. I can't help but speculate here a little bit and think that perhaps Peter's motivation to say this came from a similar place as his motivation to say to Jesus on that stormy night out on the lake, Lord, if it's you, command me to come out on the water. Because for Peter, in moments like this, in moments of confusion and fear, it's no longer about Jesus, but about him. Because you would think by this time Peter would know better than to correct or disagree with Jesus. And it looks to me like Jesus had enough of it. He said, truly, I tell you this very night before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times. If at this moment you had committed to following Jesus and you heard him say, you're going to fail me, how would you respond? If you had committed your life to following Jesus and he turned to you and said, you are going to fail me, what's your response? Maybe if I thought I was going to fail you, I wouldn't have committed my life to following you. If I was going to fail a job, I wouldn't do it. But there's a better response to knowing that we're going to fail at some point. Like I would say to Jesus, or I'd like to say to him, perhaps, please don't stop loving me. Forgive me. When the moment comes, let me come back to you. But that's not how Peter and the other disciples responded. Instead, they said, even if we must die, I will not deny you. I won't do that. Look, Jesus, I know that you know what's going to happen before it happens. I know that you and the Father are one. I know that you have the ability to heal and to forgive. But you're wrong here. That's not going to happen. I won't do that. But again, in this moment of confusion and fear, Peter is thinking about what he can or cannot do or what he does or doesn't want to do. He's thinking about himself when he needs to be hearing and focusing on Christ. And again, in these types of moments, it could be a moment, a crowning occasion for their faith, but it quickly becomes catastrophic, or it could be. Beginning in verse 57 of the same chapter, it says, and those who had seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders had gathered. And Peter was following him at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and going inside, he sat with the guards to see the end. Peter's right there the whole time, but he maintains his distance. He was sitting outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came up to him and said, you also were with Jesus the Galilean. But he denied it before them all, saying, I don't know what you mean. When he went out to the entrance, another servant girl saw him and said to the bystanders, this man was with Jesus of Nazareth. And again, he denied with an oath, I do not know what you mean. After a little while, the bystanders came and said to Peter, certainly you too are one of them, for your accent betrays you. And they began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, I do not know the man. And immediately the rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the saying of Jesus, before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times. And he went out and wept bitterly. Let me ask you something. Why did Peter deny Jesus? If Peter had the faith to step out of the boat onto the water, why would he deny the one that rescued him when he lost his faith in the midst of the storm? If Peter was willing to rebuke Jesus for foretelling his death, why would he distance himself and deny him when it happened? Peter was willing to lift himself up as superior to some of the other disciples as they sat down together. at this pivotal moment when Jesus says they're all going to fall and Peter says, I'm not going to do that. Why would he then turn around and do that? This was the moment. This was the moment that he could have done something that nobody else was willing to do. This was the moment that he could have said, yes, I'm with him. I've walked with him. I've talked with him. I've taught with him. I'm willing to die with him. Could have been a crowning moment. But again, it almost became catastrophic to his faith. It says he went out and he wept bitterly. But as depressed as he became, as full of self-doubt and brokenness as he could have been, he's given a second chance, a second life because of one thing. John chapter 21, beginning in verse 1, as we read a moment ago, says after the resurrection of Jesus, it says, after this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. As he revealed himself in this way, Simon Peter, Thomas, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, the two others of his disciples, they were together. Simon Peter said to them, I'm going fishing. And they said to him, we will go with you. And they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore. Yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, children, do you have any fish? They answered him, no. He said, cast the net on the right side of the boat and you'll find some. So they cast it, and now they're not able to haul it in because of the quantity of the fish. And that disciple whom Jesus loved therefore said to Peter, it's the Lord. And when Simon Peter heard this, that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. And the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. He came back. And Peter goes back to being a dirty, smelly, untrained, uneducated fisherman for a moment. I like to fish. Every now and then I'm lucky enough to catch something, but I still go. There's times where, when we were getting ready to move to come down here, it was just stressful, right? Kids were having a hard time knowing the journey that was coming, the confusion of the moment. The house was a loud place. It was chaotic and stressful, and there was times I was like, I got to get out. I'm going to go fishing. I get that. Peter, I think, is a similar thing here. There's chaos, there's confusion, not sure what to do. I'm going to go fishing. I'm going to go back to my original comfort zone here. Jesus comes back to them. Verse 7 told us that when Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and he threw himself into the sea. If you've seen the movie Forrest Gump, you might remember a scene right after Forrest goes out and he purchases a shrimping boat. He's piloting his boat through what looks like a canal of some sort when he sees his old friend, Lieutenant Dan, standing or sitting in his wheelchair on a dock. The boat's moving, and the man, Forrest, he throws himself off the moving boat and swims to Lieutenant Dan. He's so excited to see him. The boat crashes into the shore. I pictured that moment being somewhat similar to what Peter did. He sees Jesus alive standing at the shore, and forget waiting for the boat to get back. I've got to get to him as quickly as possible, and he jumps in the sea. After taking his eyes off of him in the storm, after rebuking him at the table, after denying him in the courtyard, Peter had to get back to Jesus. The question for us now is this. Does the fact that Jesus rose from the grave call you to him the same way it called Peter to him? Jesus once said to Peter, follow me and I will make you a fisher of men. He said to him, come to me in the midst of the storm. But this time, Jesus doesn't have to say anything directly to Peter. Just the fact that he stood in front of him, resurrected from the dead, was all that he needed. The journey continues in verse 15 of John 21. It says, when they'd finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go." This is said to show what kind of death he was to glorify to God. After saying this, he said to him, "Follow me." Something's made clear here. Whether it was on the shore of Galilee or in the midst of the storm or at the table of the Passover, after the resurrection of the Lord, Peter never stopped loving Jesus. He never stopped being willing to follow him when he was called. Despite his failures, despite his moments of weakness, he would listen. He would love him. We're going to fail. For a lot of us, it's not we're going, we have. We can plan to be unsinkable. We can be confident in our wholeness, but we're going to break. And that's okay. You know why? It's difficult to love a Savior that we do not need. In those moments where we realize our failing, Jesus looks to us and says again, "Follow me." As you evaluate your life this morning, there's an opportunity to ask where you're at. Are you in a moment of weakness, in a moment where things are falling apart and you don't know where to turn? Hear Jesus say, "Come to me, or follow me." If you're not a Christian, you've not become a Christian by putting Christ on in baptism, now is the time to do that as you hear him say, "Follow me." If there's any way our church family can be of help to you this morning, we invite you to let us know now while together we stand and sing.